I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, New Yorker editor David Remnick talks to Julian Castro, the United States Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Castro's department is working to address the rise in housing inequality.
One of the striking things about this campaign has been the degree to which income inequality has emerged as a political and moral issue. We've heard about it not just as a central point in the Democratic debates, but from Republican candidates as well. Inequality is tied up completely with so many issues, tax policy, financial regulation, jobs, trade agreements, but also with housing. We have a huge discrepancy between cities with too few jobs and very little investment, and those cities are falling apart. And then there are cities where we can't even afford to live. So I wanted to speak with the man who, more than any other, steers the government's policy on housing. Julian Castro was the mayor of San Antonio when he was asked to give the keynote address at the 2012 Democratic Convention, and then 2 years later, he was appointed to Obama's cabinet as Secretary for Housing and Urban Development. His star is rising fast in the Democratic Party, and he's been mentioned quite a lot lately as a vice presidential pick to Hillary Clinton. We spoke about the ways in which housing policy is so intertwined with wealth inequality and racial segregation. Mr. Secretary, we're just south of some of the tallest new buildings in New York City, these giant spires that are three-quarters empty, and they represent the increasing gap, not only in income but in housing, between the super wealthy and the poor, the middle class, and even the upper middle class. And I'd like to get a sense of how this subject, which is at the center of the debate, in the Democratic Party at least, about income inequality, affects housing.
It's an integral part of it. More and more families are spending more than a third, sometimes more than 50% of their income on the rent. And the thing is that it's not just in the usual suspect cities, New York, Boston, San Francisco, Chicago. It's also in middle America.
How do you feel about the question of gentrification?
This is an issue, the issue of gentrification and displacement, that I saw and dealt with as mayor of San Antonio. We had this zoning case in which folks who had lived in a trailer park basically were moved out, evicted from that trailer park because a new developer came in and wanted to build a luxury housing along the San Antonio River. And as mayor, I opposed the zoning case and said, you know, let's try and slow this down. But my experience from that was that I really couldn't think of any American city that has dealt very well with that issue of gentrification and displacement.
Because you have a clash of values.
You have a clash of values, and you have neighborhoods that are vulnerable and distressed, and folks in the neighborhood genuinely want some of the amenities. They want a supermarket. They want more restaurants and some investment in that neighborhood, better infrastructure. That happens. Other folks of higher income move in, and the neighborhood character and composition starts to change. And then all of a sudden, you reach a tipping point where folks can't afford to live in that neighborhood
anymore. And they sell and they leave.
Yeah, some sell, some make a profit, the homeowners who have been there for a while. The inconclusive part of this, you know, what the researchers tell me, is that there hasn't been enough longitudinal research on what happens to the residents, where they go, who are displaced. And so do we know definitively in each case where you see a neighborhood turn over because of gentrification that on net the impact is negative? That's where the research is sketchy right now.
Isn't this all getting complicated by businesses like Airbnb? There are a lot of landlords that prefer to use their buildings as Airbnb because it's more profitable than to rent them out.
Absolutely. It is complicated by that. In fact, there are a wave of cities that are looking at ordinances, some that have passed ordinances on these short-term rentals to try and regulate them. Let me just say that I do think that if you have a proliferation of that type of short-term rentals.
We have it. We have a proliferation. Is Airbnb a fair business in your mind for the social good?
I think in the right measure that it can work.
How do you do the right measure? What would that be?
That's a good question.
You're the
I'll
secretary.
Leave that right now to later discussion.
Okay. One of the amazing things about poverty in this country now is that it's become as much suburban as it is urban. God knows we haven't won the war on poverty in our cities, but It has become a very suburban problem as well. How does that affect housing?
Number one, it means that at the local level, many of these suburbs, because you're right, there is a suburbanization of poverty, they're having to deal with issues around affordable housing, around homelessness that they haven't had to deal with. And it's a shock to the system in many instances.
But are you seeing the same trends that you've always seen in cities, that there's all kinds of subtle and not so subtle means of discriminatory housing? Is that happening in the suburbs with the same intensity that we saw in American cities in the earlier part of the 20th century and right through the 20th century?
Oh, there is no doubt in my mind that that still exists in America, and that in a number of suburbs in any given region, you will find a strong resistance to any type of affordable housing. So yes, we still have challenges. The approach that we have taken is that last year in 2015, we came out with a new rule called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And this is a piece of unfinished business from the 1968 Fair Housing Act that basically says the Secretary of HUD has an obligation to affirmatively further fair housing, and communities that get our dollars have to help ensure that there is a fair housing approach that happens in that community.
Housing discrimination and its role in systematic racism in our cities is so intense that a number of writers, particularly Ta-Nehisi Coates, has included it in his main reasons for the need for reparations in this country. How do you feel about that argument?
There is no question that historically, the redlining that occurred early on in FHA's history, its complicity in keeping folks from opportunity because of the color of their skin, their racial or ethnic background, that set families back. And so I definitely understand the sentiment and the logic behind that. Now, today, FHA has become a powerful vehicle for families of color, families of modest means, to be able to get that first home loan.
Now, you've gotten a lot of plaudits in the Democratic Party, but you've gotten one particular stream of criticism that I'd like you to answer. Earlier this month, a coalition of liberal groups attacked you for HUD's sale of underwater mortgages to banks. What percentage of these mortgages are going to big banks? The groups put the number at almost absolute, at 98%.
Yeah. So what they were talking about is something called a distressed asset stabilization program. And the idea was that for families, borrowers in a home that were behind on their loan, that we would essentially get those notes into the hands of other servicers who would work with them to try and stave off foreclosure. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's true that a lot of folks that got these, purchased these notes are private sector actors, banks and so forth. But the entire idea of the program and what the program is aiming at is to actually keep people in their home.
But the financial institutions that are buying the most mortgages from HUD are where? The groups that are criticizing you, say Blackstone Group, for example, is notorious for its foreclosure record. Are you concerns about this?
Oh, no. I definitely wanted to make sure that we improve the program. And so in 2015, shortly after I got in 2014, I heard the critique that folks made. And I said, yeah, you know what? I agree with you that we want to improve the outcomes for these families. So we started a nonprofit-only pool of loans to be auctioned off that could only go to nonprofits that were trying to work in the community to have better outcomes for the borrowers and also for the neighborhoods. And we said, for the folks who do buy the notes, that you have to wait an extra year mm-hmm. before somebody can actually lose their home. So my point to the advocates was, I think we're on the same page that we want good outcomes for those borrowers. We have made practical improvements to this program, and we're going to continue to make more. The critique I had of their approach, though, was that just shouting Wall Street, sloganeering in a way, does not go to the merits of the program and how it's working and how we can actually improve it.
Is that part of your critique of Bernie Sanders?
I haven't critiqued Sanders in that way. It's just part of my critique of, in general, what I have seen on the other side of the aisle over these last several years is a Tea Party that has sloganeered to death And we're seeing the fruit of that in Trump and in Cruz today. And on this side of the aisle, the day that we do the same thing and forego being thoughtful about policy and actually constructing something that works, the day that we go the way of just sloganeering and letting that influence what everybody does, then we're going to become the same thing that the other guys are becoming in front of our eyes. And I consider myself a pretty progressive person, and I think I have a track record that shows that. But I'm also not just going to do a policy because it's the liberal thing to do. I'm going to implement a policy because it's well thought out and it makes sense and it's going to help those homeowners and it's actually going to work.
So you're a secretary in Obama's cabinet and your brother Joaquin is a congressman representing Texas. You're both very much a part of the political establishment, and yet you come from parents who were political activists. So please tell me about them.
Well, you know, my mother and father, they were never married, but they were together until we were about eight. And both of them had been active in the old Chicano movement of the late 1960s and early 70s, which was basically the Mexican-American civil rights movement. And my mother ran for city council when she was 23 years old in San Antonio.
And they were born
My parents were born
here
in the United States in San Antonio. And my mother jumped into politics. Eventually, she ran for city council. And then she was part of this Raza Unida party, basically, which was a third party that said at that time that neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party was serving the needs of the large Hispanic community there in Texas. And she ran under a slate called the Committee for Barrio Betterment. And their slogan was, give government back to the people. And the first thing that I put in my office when I became mayor of San Antonio was an old poster, campaign poster of hers from when she ran. She ran for city council in 1971.
What did the poster say?
It's just their faces and the district that they were running, and it has that slogan of give government back to the people. And she lost. She didn't win because there were no single-member districts. And so very few women and very few minorities did win in big cities at that time before single-member districts.
Now, after your parents split, your circumstances became particularly stressed.
Yeah. You know, my brother and I were growing up with my mother and my grandmother there on the west side of San Antonio. I remember when we applied to college that year that we were applying, my mother had made $19,000 or $20,000, and my grandmother was getting a few hundred dollars every month in Social Security check. Joaquin and I both got admission into Stanford University, and then a couple of weeks later, we got the bill for how much it would cost.
What was the bill at that time?
At that time, Stanford cost between $27,000 and $28,000 all in per person, which is probably a bargain today, but there was no way that these two women who had worked hard their entire lives could afford that opportunity for us. The only reason that I was blessed with the opportunity I had to go to Stanford was that my family had worked hard and my brother and I had worked hard in school, but then also there were Pell Grants and there were Perkins loans and there was federal work study. The recipe for success in this country has been expecting hard work from individuals and their families, but then when that happens, matching that with an investment in opportunity. And what we need in this 21st century is an updated blueprint for opportunity for folks. But that's how I look at the potential for government.
What's the most creative way someone has tried to ask you whether you will be the vice presidential nominee? And what's the tape loop you spin to deny it?
Usually they're kind enough to be fairly straightforward about it.
I'm not.
I've legitimately been asked that question, I think.
47,000
times.
Yeah,
many times. I don't know what's going to happen. I honestly don't believe that that's going to happen. And I do expect to be back in Texas next year.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was HUD Secretary Julian Castro talking with David Remnick.